This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Khalil Gibran's Little Book of Love, compiled by Neil Douglas Klotz. This book is read by Kevin Kennerly. For all the lovers separated by another's illusion of the other. Introduction. Khalil Gibran's aphorisms, stories, and poetry on the theme of love remain some of those best known to Western readers. The Lebanese-American writer's views, however, extend beyond the most quoted greeting card sayings to a very wide realm of human relationships. Passion, desire, idealized love, justice, friendship, and the challenges of dealing with strangers, neighbors, and enemies. These new little book collections take a fresh look at Gibran's words and wisdom, taking into account the major influences in his life, his Middle Eastern culture, nature, mysticism, and spirituality. One could easily argue that what the average reader of Gibran in the 1920s found exotic was the way he clearly expressed a region that most regarded as a conundrum. Nearly 100 years later, understanding the Middle Eastern conundrum, especially regarding human relationships and the treatment of the other, has moved from the level of a philosophical problem to become a practical matter of everyday survival. The book before you collects Gibran's words on love and relationships. The first in the series collected his writings on life and nature. The next book will focus on life's paradoxes and the mysteries of the inner path, and the final one on wisdom for daily life, both in solitude and in community. At first glance, Gibran may seem to be a romantic, a poet of idealized love, yet he was not a sentimentalist. He understood from his own experience the darker side of relationships, longing, sorrow, loss, lust, and passion, and its value in helping the soul's journey through life. Rather than espousing a platonic love beyond the flesh, neither soul nor body gets preferential treatment in his writings. One sees several influences here. First, Gibran's personal love relationships were fraught throughout his short life. As his various biographers relate, no personal testimony, especially his own, can be taken at face value as what happened. See about the author at the back of this book. Even in Gibran's recounting of his first love, in The Broken Wings, we find long dialogues or monologues that stretch credibility in terms of what we might call factual reporting. In his defense, we could say that Gibran was aware that different people can have very different recollections of important incidents or conversations, especially those concerned with love. Such events make an emotional impact on memory that influence us in ways we can often only explain to ourselves much later, or not at all. Second, Gibran's Middle Eastern language and culture offer very nuanced views of love, which reveal the small emotional corner into which we have painted ourselves through the over-sexualized content found today on the internet, in popular films, and in advertising. Like many languages, Gibran's native Arabic has several different words that can be literally translated as love. One concerns love's desire and passion, the word ishq, which we could describe as the magnetism that draws individuals together, like the force of gravity, and attaches them to each other like glue. This glue of the universe operates above, below, and beyond our logical human intentions. The phrase "I couldn't help myself" is apropos here. The Song of Songs in the Jewish scriptures describes this force of burning passion between two lovers exquisitely in Hebrew. At the same time, some early Sufi poets identify this relentless force of love and passion with God, or reality itself. Another ancient Semitic word for love, ahava in Hebrew, ahibva in Jesus' Aramaic, muhabba in Arabic, concerns the varieties of human relationship which emerge as a seed of respect or tolerance, then sprout into friendship and blossom as intimate, enduring love. Another image presented by the language's roots show a small flame sparked from kindling, which gradually becomes a large fire, good for cooking and warming oneself. Yet another word for love, Chram in Hebrew, Chramei in Aramaic, Rahman and Rahim in Arabic, derives from that for womb. The word's roots imply that physical birth originates as a radiance that comes from inside. This same creative radiance develops into what we call compassion, mercy, or unconditional love. The word for heart is similarly very old in the culture. The Hebrew levva and the Aramaic levha both show a creative force that is the essence or center of one's life. The Arabic words love and kalb derive from these earlier ones. The latter word revealing that the heart can have a changing surface as well as a stable depth. While today we highly prize the brain as the essential organ of consciousness, the ancients in the Middle East valued the heart much more. Perhaps this is why the ancient Egyptians preserved the physical hearts of their royalty after mummification and tossed the brain away. They felt the pharaohs would need the heart in the afterlife. The brain, not so much. As I noted in the previous collection on life, Sufi poetry and storytelling was a major influence on Gibran. Take, for instance, one of his sayings on love from the book Sand and Foam. Love is the veil between lover and lover. Then compare it to one from the 13th century Sufi poet Jalaluddin Rumi. The beloved is all in all. The lover, only a veil over her. The idea of love revealing and veiling, of a veritable house of mirrors that influences our relationships, was spoken about in the Sufi poetry from early on, yet only recently articulated in the Western psychological language of projection and transference. Again, from Gibran, lovers embrace that which is between them, rather than each other. At the same time, Gibran beautifully expresses the Middle Eastern view that love, whether expressed in pleasure or pain, in a passionate embrace or an intense, unfulfilled longing, can lead one to a much larger sense of life. This collection draws on Gibran's incredible late book on Jesus, entitled Jesus, the Son of Man. In a very modern way, Gibran tells the prophet's story from the viewpoints of many different people who knew him, some mentioned in the Bible, others not. In this little book on love, we hear several times from Mary Magdalene, from Salome, who danced for King Herod, then demanded John the Baptist's head, from a neighbor of Jesus' mother, from Judas's mother, and from the apostles Peter and John. As I noted in the earlier collection, Gibran was raised as a Maronite Christian, an Eastern church allied to the Roman Catholic, but that until the 18th century, spoke and used in liturgy the Syriac language related to Jesus' native Aramaic. The Aramaic-speaking churches historically view Jesus, the prophet of Nazareth, as a human being, a small s son of God, who uniquely fulfilled his destiny and expressed the divine life in a way open to all of us. In this sense, we can all become children of God, that is, of sacred unity. The literal translation of the Aramaic word for God, Alaha. Consistent with this, toward the end of Jesus, the Son of Man, Gibran has Mary Magdalene say, "There is a gulf that yawns between those who love him and those who hate him, between those who believe and those who do not believe. But when the years have bridged that gulf, you shall know that he who lived in us is deathless, that he was the Son of God, even as we are the children of God, that he was born of a virgin, even as we are born of the husbandless earth." Yet in writing of love, Gibran breaks through the boundaries of conventional religion in any form. In one of his most daring works, a poetic cycle entitled The Earth Gods, Gibran has the ancient gods of earth bemoan the predictability of life and its boring routine. They have almost talked themselves into full-fledged funk when one of them notices a lover and beloved singing and dancing, then embracing and making love in the middle of the forest. This changes everything, and the old gods are simultaneously baffled and thrilled by the unpredictable power of love's passion. I've included the love parts of this work, but the whole poem is worth the reader's attention. In all of his writings, Gibran's love for his native land and people shines through. When he left Lebanon with his family in 1895, it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Gibran saw himself as Syrian, culturally. Neither the states of Syria nor Lebanon existed before World War I, and throughout his life worked for the liberation of his people from oppressive regimes. He was disappointed by the way they were betrayed when Western powers carved up the Middle East into various countries and spheres of influence after the war. He took this betrayal personally, as a betrayal of friendship. In his essay, A Poet's Voice, from the book A Tear and a Smile, he laments, "You are my brothers and sisters, but why are you quarreling with me? Why do you invade my country and try to subjugate me for the sake of pleasing those who are seeking glory and authority?" I've included a number of selections from this essay, and invite the reader to listen to Gibran's voice with the current conflicted situations in the Middle East in mind. On the actual editing, it is clear that Gibran was helped with his grammar and punctuation by various people, particularly his longtime muse and editor, Mary Haskell. As the way we read has changed over the past 100 years, So is grammar. So I have re-edited or relined many selections in order to bring out the rhythm of Gibran's voice for the modern reader. As far as Gibran's use of gender-inclusive or exclusive terms go, I've mostly taken a hands-off approach. Throughout his writing, Gibran often refers to God as he, but he also refers to life as she, and makes frequent references to goddesses. In the total picture, things balance out, which is what one finds in reading gendered languages like ancient Hebrew or classical Arabic, where the sun, moon, and various living beings of nature have gendered forms. A good example in this collection is the love song of the wave, in which the sea, here feminine, embraces the shore, masculine. Instead of adhering to stereotypical human ideas of gender, Gibran asks us to expand beyond the human. In one exception to this editing policy, I've substituted humanity for mankind. This does not disturb the rhythm of Gibran's voice, is more faithful to the underlying and gender-neutral Arabic word he was thinking of, and is a more accurate way of including us all. Likewise, I've made gender-neutral one of the sections of Gibran's poet's voice pieces included here. Given current events in the Middle East, not so unlike what occurred in Gibran's time, I believe that this small change emphasizes the immediacy of his voice. In selecting the material for this book, I have placed well-known sayings of Gibran next to lesser-known ones, organized by the various faces and stages of love that his writing describes. We begin with love's initiation, beauty, passion, and desire. After this comes love's many complexities and challenges, its veils. Then we explore the varieties of human relationship in which love plays hide-and-seek with us. Finally, we are led further on love's path, which points beyond our human lifespan. As Rumi urges, whether you love God or love a human being, if you love enough, you will come into the presence of love itself. And as Gibran says wistfully towards the end of the prophet, a little while, and my longing shall gather dust and foam for another body. A little while, a moment of rest upon the wind, and another woman shall bear me. Neil Douglas Klotz, Fife, Scotland, October 2017. 1. Love's Initiation. The spring of love introduces us to beauty, desire, and passion. What part does the smoke of love play in relation to love's enduring fire? The spring of love. Come, my beloved, let us walk amidst the knolls. For the snow is water, and life is alive from its slumber, and is roaming the hills and valleys. Let us follow the footprints of spring into the distant fields, and mount the hilltops to draw inspiration high above the cool green plains. Dawn of spring has unfolded her winter-kept garment, and placed it on the peach and citrus trees, and they appear as brides in the ceremonial custom of the night of Kaaba. The sprigs of grapevine embrace each other like sweethearts, and the brooks burst out and dance between the rocks, repeating the song of joy. The flowers bud suddenly from the heart of nature, like foam from the rich heart of the sea. Come, my beloved, let us drink the last of winter's tears from the cupped lilies, and soothe our spirits with a shower of notes from the birds, wandering in exhilaration through the intoxicating breeze. Let us sit by that rock where violets hide. Let us pursue their exchange of the sweetness of kisses. Night of Qadr, also called Laylatul Qadr, the night of power. In the Islamic traditions, this is the night on which Prophet Muhammad first began to receive the Quran. It is marked on one of the last days of the month of Ramadan. The night is said to hold special blessings, and so was sometimes considered an auspicious time for a wedding in Lebanon. Beauty in the heart. There are only two elements here, beauty and truth. Beauty in the hearts of lovers and truth in the arms of the tillers of the soil. Great beauty captures me, but a beauty still greater frees me, even from itself. Beauty shines brighter in the heart of the one who longs for it than in the eyes of the one who sees it. First love. I was 18 years of age when love opened my eyes with its magic rays and touched my spirit for the first time with its fiery fingers. And Selma Karami was the first woman who awakened my spirit with her beauty and led me into the garden of thy affection, where days pass like dreams, and nights like weddings. Selma Karami was the one who taught me to worship beauty by the example of her own beauty, and revealed to me the secret of love by her affection. She was the one who first sang to me the poetry of real life. Every young man remembers his first love, and tries to recapture that strange hour, the memory of which changes his deepest feeling, and makes him so happy in spite of all the bitterness of its mystery. In every young man's life, there is a Selma, who appears to him suddenly while in the spring of life, and transforms his solitude into happy moments, and fills the silence of his nights with music. I was deeply engrossed in thought and contemplation, and seeking to understand the meaning of nature and the revelation of books and scriptures, when I heard love whispered into my ears through Selma's lips. My life was a coma, empty like that of Adam's in paradise, when I saw Selma standing before me like a column of light. She was the Eve of my heart, who filled it with secrets and wonders and made me understand the meaning of life. The first Eve led Adam out of paradise by her own will, while Selma made me enter willingly into the paradise of pure love and virtue by her sweetness and love. But what happened to the first man also happened to me, and the fiery word that chased Adam out of paradise was like the one that frightened me by its glittering edge and forced me away from the paradise of my love without having disobeyed any order or tasted the fruit of the forbidden tree. Today, after many years have passed, I have nothing left out of that beautiful dream except painful memories flapping like invisible wings around me, filling the depths of my heart with sorrow and bringing tears to my eyes. And my beloved, beautiful Selma is dead. And nothing is left to commemorate her except my broken heart and a tomb surrounded by cypress trees. That tomb and this heart are all that is left to bear witness of Selma. The silence that guards the tomb does not reveal God's secret lying in the obscurity of the coffin, and the rustling of the branches, whose roots suck the body's elements, do not tell the mysteries of the grave. But the agonized sighs of my heart announce to the living the drama that love, beauty, and death have performed. O friends of my youth who are scattered in the city of Beirut, when you pass by the cemetery near the pine forest, enter it silently and walk slowly, so the tramping of your feet will not disturb the slumber of the dead. Stop humbly by Selma's tomb, and greet the earth that encloses her corpse, and mention my name with a deep sigh, and say to yourself, "Here all the hopes of Gibran, who is living as a prisoner of love beyond the seas, were buried. On this spot, he lost his happiness, drained his tears, and forgot his smile. By that tomb grows Gibran's sorrow together with the cypress trees, and above the tomb, his spirit flickers every night commemorating Selma, joining the branches of the trees in sorrowful wailing, mourning and lamenting the going of Selma, who yesterday was a beautiful tune on the lips of life, and today is a silent secret in the bosom of the earth. O comrades of my youth, I appeal to you in the names of those virgins whom your hearts have loved to lay a wreath of flowers on the forsaken tomb of my beloved. For the flowers you lay on Selma's tomb are like falling drops of dew from the eyes of dawn on the leaves of a withering rose." Wandering Desire. When you were a wandering desire in the mist, I too was there, a wandering desire. Then we sought one another, and out of our eagerness, dreams were born. And dreams were time limitless, and dreams were space without measure. And when you were a silent word upon life's quivering lips, I too was there, another silent word. Then life uttered us, and we came down through the years, throbbing with memories of yesterday and with longing for tomorrow. For yesterday was death conquered, and tomorrow was birth pursued. Singing the Heart. Our mind is a sponge. Our heart is a stream. When life does not find a singer to sing her heart, she produces a philosopher to speak her mind. Beauty and Love. Beauty has its own heavenly language, loftier than the voices of tongues and lips. It is a timeless language, common to all humanity, a calm lake that attracts the singing rivulets to its depths and makes them silent. Only our spirits can understand beauty or live and grow with it. It puzzles our minds. We are unable to describe it in words. It is a sensation that our eyes cannot see, derived from both the one who observes and the one who is looked upon. Real beauty is a ray that emanates from the Holy of Holies of the Spirit and illuminates the body, as life comes from the depths of the earth and gives color and scent to a flower. Did my spirit and Selma's reach out to each other that day when we met? And did that yearning make me see her as the most beautiful woman under the sun? Or was I intoxicated with the wine of youth, which made me fancy that which never existed? Did my youth blind my natural eyes and make me imagine the brightness of her eyes, the sweetness of her mouth, and the grace of her figure? Or was it that her brightness, sweetness, and grace opened my eyes and showed me the happiness and sorrow of love? It is hard to answer these questions, but I say truly that in that hour, I felt an emotion that I had never felt before, a new affection resting calmly in my heart, like the spirit hovering over the waters at the creation of the world. And from that affection was born my happiness and my sorrow. Thus ended the hour of my first meeting with Selma, and thus the will of heaven freed me from the bondage of youth and solitude, and let me walk in the procession of love. If you have desires. Love has no other desire but to fulfill itself. But if you love and must have desires, let these be your desires. To melt and be like a running brook that sings its melody to the night. To know the pain of too much tenderness. To be wounded by your own understanding of love and to bleed willingly and joyfully. To wake at dawn with a winged heart and to give thanks for another day of loving. To rest at the noon hour and meditate love's ecstasy. To return home at eventide with gratitude and then to sleep with a prayer for the beloved in your heart and a song of praise upon your lips. Describing first love. A woman whom Providence has provided with beauty of spirit and body is a truth, at the same time both open and secret. We can understand that truth only by love, and touch it only by virtue. And when we attempt to describe such a woman, she disappears like vapor. Selma Karami had bodily and spiritual beauty, but how can I describe her to one who never knew her? Can a dead man remember the singing of a nightingale, the fragrance of a rose, and the sigh of a brook? Can a prisoner, who was heavily loaded with shackles, follow the breeze of the dawn? Is not silence more painful than death? Does pride prevent me from describing Selma in plain words, since I cannot draw her truthfully with luminous colors? A hungry man in a desert will not refuse to eat dry bread, even if heaven does not shower him with manna and quails. Mistaken identity. Upon a day, beauty and ugliness met on the shore of a sea, and they said to one another, "Let us bathe in the sea." Then they disrobed and swam in the waters, and after a while, ugliness came back to the shore and clothed himself with the garments of beauty and walked away. And beauty too came out of the sea and found not her raiment, and she was too shy to be naked, so she dressed herself with the raiment of ugliness, and beauty walked her way. And to this very day, men and women mistake the one for the other. Yet there are some who have beheld the face of beauty, and they know her, notwithstanding her garments. And there are some who know the face of ugliness, and the cloth conceals them not from their eyes. Love's summer. Let us go into the fields, my beloved, for the time of harvest approaches, and the sun's eyes are ripening the grain. Let us tend the fruit of the earth, as the spirit nourishes the grains of joy from the seeds of love sowed deep in our hearts. Let us fill our bins with the products of nature, as life fills so abundantly the domain of our hearts with her endless bounty. Let us make the flowers our bed, and the sky our blanket, and rest our heads together upon pillows of soft hay. Let us relax after the day's toil, and listen to the provoking murmur of the brook. O love! They say the jackal and the mole drink from the same stream where the lion comes to drink. And they say the eagle and the vulture dig their beaks into the same carcass and are at peace, one with the other, in the presence of the dead thing. O love, whose lordly hand has bridled my desires and raised my hunger and my thirst to dignity and pride, let not the strong and constant in me eat the bread or drink the wine that tempt my weaker self. Let me rather starve, and let my heart parch with thirst, and let me die and perish before I stretch my hand to a cup you did not fill, or a bowl you did not bless. Desire is half. Desire is half of life. Indifference is half of death. Between desire and peace. They say to me, you must choose between the pleasures of this world and the peace of the next world. And I say to them, I have chosen both the delights of this world and the peace of the next. For I know in my heart that the supreme poet wrote but one poem, and it scans perfectly, and it also rhymes perfectly. Faith is an oasis in the heart that will never be reached by the caravan of thinking. When you reach your height, you shall desire only for desire, and you shall hunger only for hunger, and you shall thirst only for greater thirst. God moves in passion. Your reason and your passion are the rudder and the sails of your seafaring soul. If either your sails or your rudder be broken, you can but toss and drift, or else be held at a standstill in mid-seas. For reason ruling alone is a force confining, and passion unattended is a flame that burns to its own destruction. Therefore, let your soul exalt your reason to the height of passion that it may sing, and let it direct your passion with reason, that your passion may live through its own daily resurrection, and like the phoenix, rise above its own ashes. I would have you consider your judgment and your appetite even as you would two loved guests in your house. Surely you would not honor one guest above the other, for the one who is more mindful of one loses the love and faith of both. Among the hills, when you sit in the cool shade of the white poplars, sharing the peace and serenity of distant fields and meadows, then let your heart say in silence, God rests in reason. And when the storm comes, and the mighty wind shakes the forest, and thunder and lightning proclaim the majesty of the sky, then let your heart say in awe, God moves in passion. And since you are a breath in God's sphere and a leaf in God's forest, you too should rest in reason and move in passion. Voices in rapture. The ancient earth gods, weary and depressed, converse among themselves about life's purpose or the lack of it, until one of them notices, a youth in yonder vale is singing his heart to the night. His lyre is gold and ebony. His voice is silver and gold. Down in the myrtle grove, a girl is dancing to the moon. 1,000 dew stars are in her hair. About her feet, 1,000 wings. The girl has found the singer. She sees his raptured face. Panther-like, she slips with subtle steps through rustling vine and fern. And now amid his ardent cries, he gazes full on her. Oh, my brothers, my heedless brothers, is it some other god in passion who has woven this web of scarlet and white? What unbridled star has gone astray? Whose secret keeps night from morning, and whose hand is upon our world? They meet, two star-bound spirits in the sky encountering. In silence, they gaze one upon the other. He sings no more, and yet his sunburnt throat throbs with the song, and in her limbs, the happy dance is stayed, but not asleep. Brothers, my strange brothers, the night waxes deep and brighter as the moon, and between the meadow and the sea, a voice in rapture calls you and me. Your body is the harp of your soul. But tell me, who is the one that can offend the spirit? Shall the nightingale offend the stillness of the night, or the firefly the stars? And shall your flame or your smoke burden the wind? Do you think the spirit is a still pool that you can trouble with a staff? Oftentimes, in denying yourself pleasure, you only store the desire in the recesses of your being. Who knows whether that which seems omitted today waits for tomorrow? Even your body knows its heritage and its rightful need and will not be deceived. And your body is the harp of your soul. It is yours to bring forth sweet music from it or confused sounds. And now you ask in your heart, how shall we distinguish that which is good in pleasure from that which is not good? Go to your fields and your gardens, and you shall learn that it is the pleasure of the bee to gather honey of the flower. But it is also the pleasure of the flower to yield its honey to the bee. For to the bee, a flower is a fountain of life, and to the flower, a bee is a messenger of love. And to be both bee and flower, the giving and receiving of pleasure is a need and an ecstasy. If your heart is a volcano, how shall you expect flowers to bloom in your hands? I am the flame, and I am the dry bush, and one part of me consumes the other part. Love Across Age. The poet youth said to the princess, I love you. And the princess answered, and I love you too, my child. But I am not your child. I am a man, and I love you. And she said, I am the mother of sons and daughters, and they are fathers and mothers of sons and daughters, and one of the sons of my sons is older than you. And the poet youth said, but I love you. It was not long after that the princess died, but before her last breath was received again by the greater breath of earth, she said within her soul, my beloved, mine only son, my youth poet, it may yet be that some day we shall meet again, and I shall not be 70. A desire unfulfilled. Salome speaks about Jesus to a woman friend. He was like poplars, shimmering in the sun, and like a lake among the lonely hills, shining in the sun, and like snow upon the mountain heights, white, white in the sun. Yea, he was like all these, and I loved him. Yet I feared his presence, and my feet would not carry my burden of love, that I might girdle his feet with my arms. I would have said to him, I have slain your friend in an hour of passion. Will you forgive me my sin? And will you not, in mercy, release my youth from its blind deed, that it may walk in your light? I know he would have forgiven my dancing for the saintly head of his friend. I know he would have seen in me an object of his own teaching. For there was no valley of hunger he could not bridge, and no desert of thirst he could not cross. Yes, he was even as the poplars and as the lakes among the hills and like snow upon Lebanon. And I would have cooled my lips in the folds of his garment. But he was far from me, and I was ashamed, and my mother held me back when the desire to seek him was upon me. Whenever he passed by, my heart ached for his loveliness. But my mother frowned at him in contempt, and would hasten me from the window to my bedchamber, and she would cry aloud, saying, Who is he but another locust-eater from the desert? What is he but a scoffer and a renegade, a seditious riot-monger, who would rob us of scepter and crown, and bid the foxes and the jackals of his accursed land to howl in our halls and sit upon our throne? Go hide your face from this day, and await the day when his head shall fall down, but not upon your platter. These things my mother said, but my heart would not keep her words. I loved him in secret, and my sleep was girdled with flames. He is gone now, and something that was in me is gone also. Perhaps it was my youth that would not tarry here, since the god of youth was slain. A passion unspent. In the city of Shawakis lived a prince, and he was loved by everyone. Men, women, and children, even the animals of the field came to him in greeting. But all the people said that his wife, the princess, loved him not, nay, that she even hated him. And one day the princess of a neighboring city came to visit the princess of Shawakis. And they sat and talked together, and their words led to their husbands. And the princess of Shawakis said with passion, "I envy your happiness with the prince, your husband, though you have been married these many years. I hate my husband. He belongs not to me alone, and I am indeed a woman most unhappy." Then the visiting princess gazed at her and said, "My friend, the truth is that you love your husband, aye, and you still have him for a passion unspent, and that is life in a woman, like spring in a garden. But pity me and my husband, for we only endure one another in silent patience, and yet you and others deem this happiness." All the stars of my night faded away. Mary Magdalene speaks about meeting Jesus for the first time. "It was in the month of June when I saw him for the first time. He was walking in the wheat field when I passed by with my handmaidens, and he was alone. The rhythm of his steps was different from other men's, and the movement of his body was like nothing I had seen before. Men do not pace the earth in that manner, and even now, I do not know whether he walked fast or slow. My handmaidens pointed their fingers at him and spoke in shy whispers to one another, and I stayed my steps for a moment and raised my hand to hail him. But he did not turn his face, and he did not look at me, and I hated him. I was swept back into myself, and I was as cold as if I had been in a snowdrift, and I shivered. That night, I beheld him in my dreaming, and they told me afterward that I screamed in my sleep and was restless upon my bed. It was in the month of August that I saw him again through my window. He was sitting in the shadow of the cypress tree across my garden, and he was as still as if he had been carved out of stone, like the statues in Antioch and other cities of the North Country. And my slave, the Egyptian, came to me and said, 'That man is here again. He is sitting there across your garden.' And I gazed at him, and my soul quivered within me, for he was beautiful. His body was single, and each part seemed to love every other part. Then I clothed myself with raiment of Damascus, and I left my house and walked towards him. Was it my aloneness, or was it his fragrance that drew me to him? Was it a hunger in my eyes that desired comeliness, or was it his beauty that sought the light of my eyes? Even now, I do not know. I walked to him with my scented garments and my golden sandals, the sandals the Roman captain had given me, even these sandals. And when I reached him, I said, 'Good morrow to you.' And he said, 'Good morrow to you, Miriam.' And he looked at me, and his night eyes saw me as no man had seen me. And suddenly, I was as if naked, and I was shy. Yet he'd only said, 'Good morrow to you.' And then I said to him, 'Will you not come to my house?' And he said, 'Am I not already in your house?' I did not know what he meant then, but I know now. And I said, 'Will you not have wine and bread with me?' And he said, 'Yes, Miriam, but not now.' 'Not now?' 'Not now,' he said. And the voice of the sea was in those two words, and the voice of the wind and the trees, and when he said them to me, life spoke to death. For mind you, my friend, I was dead. I was a woman who had divorced her soul. I was living apart from this self that you now see. I belonged to all men, and to none. They called me harlot, and a woman possessed of seven devils. I was cursed, and I was envied. But when his dawn eyes looked into my eyes, all the stars of my night faded away, and I became Miriam, only Miriam, a woman lost to the earth she had known and finding herself in new places. And now again I said to him, 'Come into my house and share bread and wine with me.' And he said, 'Why do you bid me be your guest? And I said, I beg you to come into my house. And it was all that was sod in me, and all that was sky in me, calling unto him. Then he looked at me, and the noontide of his eyes was upon me, and he said, You have many lovers, and yet I alone love you. Other men love themselves in your nearness. I love you in yourself. Other men see a beauty in you that shall fade away sooner than their own years. But I see in you a beauty that shall not fade away. And in the autumn of your days, that beauty shall not be afraid to gaze at itself in the mirror, and it shall not be offended. I alone love the unseen in you. Then he said in a low voice, Go away now. If this cypress tree is yours, and you would not have me sit in its shadow, I will walk my way. And I cried to him, and I said, Master, come to my house. I have incense to burn for you, and a silver basin for your feet. You are a stranger, and yet not a stranger. I entreat you, come to my house. Then he stood up and looked at me, even as the seasons might look down upon the field. And he smiled, and he said again, All men love you for themselves. I love you for yourself. And then he walked away. But no other man ever walked the way he walked. Was it a breath born in my garden that moved to the east? Or was it a storm that would shake all things to their foundations? I knew not. But on that day, the sunset of his eyes slew the dragon in me. And I became a woman. I became Miriam. Miriam of Mijdel. 2. The Veils of Love. As love matures, we are challenged by our surrounding culture, as well as by the unspoken assumptions and illusions we hold. Tears come with parting, loneliness and longing. Through all these experiences, love veils and unveils itself. Love's gifts. Love provided me with a tongue and tears. The caged heart. There in the middle of the field, by the side of a crystalline stream, I saw a birdcage whose rods and hinges were fashioned by an expert's hands. In one corner lay a dead bird, and in another were two basins, one empty of water and the other of seeds. I stood there reverently, as if the lifeless bird and the murmur of the water were worthy of deep silence and respect, something worthy of examination and meditation by the heart and conscience. As I engrossed myself in view and thought, I found that the poor creature had died of thirst beside a stream of water, and of hunger in the midst of a rich field, a cradle of life. It was like a rich man locked inside his iron safe, perishing from hunger amid heaps of gold. Before my eyes, I saw the cage turn suddenly into a human skeleton, and the dead bird into a human heart, which was bleeding from a deep wound that looked like the lips of a sorrowing woman. A voice came from that wound, saying, I am the human heart, prisoner of substance, and the victim of earthly laws. In God's field of beauty, at the edge of the stream of life, I was imprisoned in the cage of laws made by humanity. In the center of beautiful creation, I died neglected, because I was kept from enjoying the freedom of God's bounty. Everything of beauty that awakens my love and desire is a disgrace, according to human conceptions. Everything of goodness that I crave is but naught, according to this judgment. I am the lost human heart, imprisoned in the foul dungeon of human dictates, tied with chains of earthly authority, dead and forgotten by laughing humanity, whose tongue is tied and whose eyes are empty of visible tears. All these words I heard, and I saw them emerging with a stream of ever-thinning blood from that wounded heart. More was said, but my misted eyes and crying soul prevented further sight or hearing. Love versus law. Those people who go back to eternity before they taste the sweetness of real life are unable to understand the meaning of a woman's suffering, especially when she devotes her soul to a man she loves by the will of God, and her body to another whom she caresses by the enforcement of earthly law. Three persons separated. Three persons were separated in thought, but united in love. Three innocent people with much feeling, but little knowledge. A drama was being performed by an old man who loved his daughter and cared for her happiness, a young woman of 20 looking into the future with anxiety, and a young man dreaming and worrying who had tasted neither the wine of life nor its vinegar and was trying to reach the height of love and knowledge but was unable to lift himself up. We three, sitting in twilight, were eating and drinking in that solitary home guarded by heaven's eyes, but at the bottoms of our glasses were hidden bitterness and anguish. What lovers embrace. Lovers embrace that which is between them, rather than each other. Two kinds of love. A man and a woman sat by a window that opened upon spring. They sat close to one another. And the woman said, "I love you. You are handsome, and you are rich, and you are always well attired." And the man said, "I love you. You are a beautiful thought, a thing too apart to hold in the hand, a song in my dreaming." But the woman turned from him in anger, and she said, "Sir, please leave me now. I am not a thought. I am not a thing that passes in your dreams. I am a woman. I would have you desire me, a wife and the mother of our unborn children." And they parted. And the man was saying in his heart, "Behold, another dream is even now turned into mist." And the woman was saying, "Well, what of a man who turns me into a mist and a dream?" Whom do we love? When I stood, a clear mirror before you, you gazed into me and saw your image. Then you said, "I love you." But in truth, you loved yourself in me. Love is the veil between lover and lover. Laughter and tears. As the sun withdrew its rays from the garden, and the moon threw cushioned beams upon the flowers, I sat under the trees, pondering upon the phenomena of the atmosphere, looking through the branches at the strewn stars, which glittered like chips of silver upon a blue carpet. And I could hear from a distance the agitated murmur of the rivulet singing its way briskly into the valley. When the birds took shelter among the boughs, and the flowers folded their petals, and tremendous silence descended, I heard a rustle of feet through the grass. I took heed, and saw a young couple approaching my arbor. They sat under a tree where I could see them without being seen. After he looked about in every direction, I heard the young men saying, "Sit by me, my beloved, and listen to my heart. Smile, for your happiness is a symbol of our future. Be merry, for the sparkling days rejoice with us. My soul is warming me of the doubt in your heart, for doubt and love is a sin. Soon you will be the owner of this vast land, lighted by this beautiful moon. Soon you will be the mistress of my palace, and all the servants and maids will obey your commands. Smile, my beloved, like the gold smiles from my father's coffers. My heart refuses to deny you its secret. 12 months of your comfort and travel await us. For a year, we will spend my father's gold at the blue lakes of Switzerland, and viewing the edifices of Italy and Egypt, and resting under the holy cedars of Lebanon. You will meet the princesses who will envy you for your jewels and clothes. All these things I will do for you. Will you be satisfied?" In a little while, I saw them walking and stepping on flowers, as the rich step upon the hearts of the poor. As they disappeared from my sight, I began to make a comparison between love and money, and to analyze their position in the heart. Money, the source of insincere love, the spring of false light and fortune, the well of poisoned water, the desperation of old age. I was still wandering in the vast desert of contemplation when a forlorn and specter-like couple passed by me and sat on the grass, a young man and a young woman who had left their farming shacks in the nearby fields for this cool and solitary place. After a few moments of complete silence, I heard the following words, uttered with sighs, from weather-bitten lips. Shed not tears, my beloved. Love that opens our eyes and enslaves our hearts can give us the blessing of patience. Be consoled in our delay, for we have taken an oath and entered love's shrine. For our love will ever grow in adversity, for it is in love's name that we are suffering the obstacles of poverty and the sharpness of misery and the emptiness of separation. I shall attack these hardships until I triumph and place in your hands a strength that will help overcome all things to complete the journey of life. Love, which is God, will consider our sighs and tears as incense burned at the altar and will reward us with fortitude. Goodbye, my beloved. I must leave before the hardening moon vanishes. A pure voice, combined with a consuming flame of love, the hopeless bitterness of longing, and the resolved sweetness of patience, said, "Goodbye, my beloved." They separated, and the elegy to their union was smothered by the wails of my crying heart. I looked upon slumbering nature, and with deep reflection discovered the reality of a vast and infinite thing, something no power could demand, influence or acquire, nor riches purchase. Nor could it be effaced by the tears of time or deadened by sorrow. A thing that cannot be discovered by the blue lakes of Switzerland or the beautiful edifices of Italy. It is something that gathers strength with patience, grows despite obstacles, warms in winter, flourishes in spring, casts a breeze in summer, and bears fruit in autumn. I found love. Love cleansed by tears. Hearts that are united through the medium of sorrow will not be separated by the glory of happiness. Love that is cleansed by tears will remain eternally pure and beautiful. A woman's heart. Selma told me, "A woman's heart will not change with time or season. Even if it dies eternally, it will never perish. A woman's heart is like a field turned into a battleground. After the trees are uprooted, and the grass is burned, and the rocks are reddened with blood, and the earth is planted with bones and skulls, it is calm and silent as if nothing had happened. For the spring and autumn come at their intervals and resume their work." Love caresses and threshes. Even as love crowns you, so shall it crucify you. Even as love is for your growth, so is love for your pruning. Even as love ascends to your height and caresses your tenderest branches that quiver in the sun, so shall love descend to your roots and shake them in their clinging to the earth. Like sheaves of corn, love gathers you unto itself. Love threshes you to make you naked. Love sifts you to free you from your husks. Love grinds you to whiteness. Love kneads you until you are pliant, and then love assigns you its sacred fire, that you may become bread for God's sacred feast. All these things shall love do unto you, that you may know the secrets of your heart, and in that knowledge, become a fragment of life's heart. Love's autumn. Let us go and gather grapes in the vineyard for the winepress, and keep the wine in old vases, as the Spirit keeps knowledge of the ages and eternal vessels. Let us return to our dwelling, for the wind has caused the yellow leaves to fall and shroud the withering flowers that whisper elegy to summer. Come home, my eternal sweetheart, for the birds have made pilgrimage to warmth and left the chilled prairies suffering pangs of solitude. The jasmine and myrtle have no more tears. Let us retreat, for the tired brook has ceased its song. The bubblesome springs are drained of their copious weeping, and the cautious old hills have stored away their colorful garments. Come, my beloved. Nature is justly weary and is bidding her enthusiasm farewell with quiet and contented melody. Between heart and soul. A lover speaks about his beloved. Blame never diverts the heart from its purpose, and loneliness deflects not the soul from the truth. A man between his heart and his soul is like a tender branch between the north and south winds. I'm following you, O love. What do you seek of me? I've walked with you upon the flaming path, and when I opened my eyes, I saw naught but darkness. My lips quivered, but you let them speak only words of misery. Love, you have made my heart hungry for the sweetness of your presence, for I am weak and you are strong. Why are you struggling with me? The brooks hurry to their lover, the sea. The flowers smile at their sweetheart, the sun. The clouds descend to their suitor, the valley. I am unheard by the brooks, unseen by the flowers, unknown to the clouds. When I discovered that you are a princess, and I looked upon my poverty, I learned that God possesses a secret unrevealed to humanity, that a secret path leads the spirit to places where love may forget the customs of the earth. When I looked at your eyes, I knew that this path leads to a paradise whose door is the human heart. Tears and dewdrops. You may forget the one with whom you have laughed, but never the one with whom you have wept. There must be something strangely sacred in salt. It is in our tears and in the sea. Our God, in his gracious thirst, will drink us all, the dewdrop and the tear. Depth. Ever has it been that love knows not its own depth until the hour of separation. Where are you now, my other self? O companion of my soul, where are you? Do you have a memory of the day we met, when the halo of your spirit surrounded us, and the angels of love floated about us, singing the praise of the soul's deed? Do you recollect our sitting in the shade of the branches, sheltering ourselves from humanity as the ribs protect the divine secret of the heart from injury? Do you remember the trails and forest we walked, with hands joined and our heads leaning against each other, as if we were hiding ourselves within ourselves? Do you recall the hour I bade you farewell, and the kiss you placed on my lips? That kiss taught me that joining lips in love reveals heavenly secrets that the tongue cannot utter. That kiss was an introduction to a great sigh, like the Almighty's breath that turned earth into a human being. I remember when you kissed me, and kissed me, with tears coursing down your cheeks, and you said, "Earthly bodies must often separate for earthly purpose, and must live apart impelled by worldly intent. But the spirit remains joined safely in the hands of love, until death arrives and takes joined souls to God. Go, my beloved. Love has chosen you, her delegate. Obey her, for she is beauty, who offers to her follower the cup of the sweetness of life. Where are you now, my other self? Are you awake in the silence of the night? Let the clean breeze convey to you my heart's every beat and affection. Are you fondling my face in your memory? That image is no longer my own, for sorrow has dropped its shadow on my happy countenance of the past. Sobs have withered my eyes, which reflected your beauty, and dried my lips, which you sweetened with kisses. Where are you, my beloved? Do you hear my weeping from beyond the ocean? Do you understand my need? Do you know the greatness of my patience? Where are you, my beautiful star? The obscurity of life has cast me upon its bosom. Sorrow has conquered me. Sail your smile into the air. It will reach and enliven me. Breathe your fragrance into the air. It will sustain me. Oh, how great is love, and how little am I. Who is crucifying the Son? Susanna of Nazareth speaks of Mary, Jesus' mother. Two Sabbaths ago, my heart was as a stone in my breast, for my son had left me for a ship in Tyre. He would be a sailor, and he said he would return no more. And upon an evening, I sought Mary. When I entered her house, she was sitting at her loom, But she was not weaving. She was looking into the sky beyond Nazareth. And I said to her,